I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum present. Just a few housekeeping items before we get to our agenda. Everyone today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in walkways or aisles. If you need accommodations, let us know. Also, signs are not permitted either in the audience or at the testifiers table. Signs should be left outside and will not tolerate outbursts or clapping or any kinds of disruptions. Before we get into our agenda, members, I also just wanted to take a minute to acknowledge and recognize the terrible day that we had in Minnesota on Sunday when we lost three heroes in the Burnsville community. And I think I speak for the committee when I say that we offer our deepest condolences to the families and the colleagues of those who lost their lives and to all of those people who knew those three heroes. Our heart also goes out to the Burnsville community, to the children who witnessed the horrible events, to the other first responders who were on the scene and who had to investigate that scene, and to all first responders, several of whom serve on this committee. To law enforcement and to other first responders, we recognize the unimaginable danger that you put yourselves in every day for the safety of all Minnesotans. We appreciate you and our hearts are with you. And I don't know if Lee Novotny has any, okay. Thank you. We'll move on to our agenda. And so the first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Curran, do you move approval of the minutes from February 15th, 2024?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion. Thank you.
Any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from February 15th, 2024 are approved. The first bill that we have on our agenda today is House File 3805. It's a Representative Norris bill, and we will be laying over this bill, so I will move to lay over House File 3805. Welcome to the committee, Representative Norris. Great to see you. I don't believe you have any amendments to your bill, and so if you want to go ahead and explain your bill for us.
Great. Thank you, Chair Moeller and members of the committee. It's great to be with you this morning. Making sure that our schools are safe for our students and the teachers and staff who work in them is top of mind for Minnesotans, and of course, it's also a top priority for us as policymakers. And while our minds sadly jump immediately to things like school shootings, the reality is most 911 calls from schools relate to situations like medical emergencies. But regardless of the type of call, seconds count. House File 3805 goes a long way toward helping our first responders navigate complex buildings to best respond to all types of incidents in our schools. This bill would fund an open RFP process through our local public safety answering point and/or emergency communication centers located throughout the state. This $6 million request would fund mapping of all public schools, charter schools, tribal schools, and any publicly funded pre-K facilities. Now, this money comes from the 911 Special Revenue Fund at DPS, and this activity is an already permissible use of this fund. I'd also like to thank my bipartisan co-authors on this bill, Representative Wolgamott, Representative Perryman, and Representative Censor Mura. One thing that's kind of a disadvantage of being one of the first bills out of the chute at the start of session is, you know, not everybody has a chance to, you know, share their feedback on the bill before it actually gets presented. And so I know I've had a number of stakeholders reach out with suggestions, feedback. So that's part of the reason we're laying it over today. We're going to get a chance to kind of get ourselves grounded in what this bill would do. But then we'll take some time, talk with stakeholders, and come back if we need to with an author's amendment before we move the bill on to its next stop. But overall, no single technology or approach is going to completely solve school safety, but I think this bill is a good step forward that's going to make a meaningful difference in the wide variety of calls for service that first responders receive from schools every day. And today I've got with me Dan Craigie from Geocom, that's a company based out of St. Cloud, who can explain a little bit more about how this money could be used.
Thank you, Representative Norris. And Dan Craigie, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Craigie, and I serve as a director at GEOCOM. As Representative Norris mentioned, this is a St. Cloud-based safety and security company focused on mapping. Previously, I served as the deputy director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division here in Minnesota. And that entity manages the statewide 911 network, our statewide radio system, the emergency alerts you get on your phone, as well as working with the federal government on the statewide broadband network for first responders. In addition, I've actually spent 5 years working in public schools, so this issue is very near and dear to my heart. So I am here to provide testimony in support of House File 3805, as well as some visual context that I'll get to about what the indoor mapping can provide and the value for first responders and public safety. Before I do that, just some comments about this. Schools are very complex structures. First responders don't always know exactly where they're going when they get an emergency or even the door to enter into. This bill aims to solve that. 911 caller location accuracy has gotten significantly better over the last 3 to 5 years, so much so that a 911 caller location can be within 2 to 3 meters, which is room level accuracy. But as of right now, the vast majority of schools or really buildings in Minnesota do not have an indoor map to provide the context for an efficient response. Again, this bill aims to at least remedy that for schools. In some cases, maps do exist, but they're likely paper-based or they're a PDF. They're not shared widely. They're not up to date. This bill aims to remedy that. Really, by building what we call an interoperable digital indoor map, public safety can easily see the location of an emergency within the school, so much that a dispatcher or 911 telecommunicator can tell a first responder exactly the door to enter into that is closest to the emergency, if there's a lockbox, if there's an AED close by. All of that information could be shared when dispatching the first responder. Really, the goal of this is to reduce response time for a first responder and get to an emergency as quickly as possible. Again, the vast majority of emergencies at schools are allergies, maybe a school fight, unruly parents can be a concern as well. And so all of those things, including an active shooter, we want to get first responders there as quickly as possible. In addition, the bill isn't explicitly covering this. This data can be used for many other purposes, facilities management, classroom management, visitor management, anything that a school needs this data for, it's interoperable data. They could use it for that. Our focus, and I think the focus of this committee is obviously public safety, but do want to reference that. I know there may be some questions here coming up later in the testimony. I just want to address briefly. A lot of schools in Minnesota are old, and so I think there's some best practices that have been discussed about you have to walk every single school to ensure that the accuracy is really where we need it to be. And we have some concern with that just wouldn't be a good use of taxpayer funds. Almost 20% of the schools in the state of Minnesota have been built since 2000. They have up-to-date and accurate GIS floor plans that we can use to build this data. So if we know at least 20%, but likely more based on renovations, and some schools are being built as we speak, that we do not have to visit all of these schools. They have floor plans that we can use. That makes the cost lower, more efficient use of taxpayer funds. Secondly, the requirement to share data and how the data is shared. Admittedly, this is an operational decision. We intentionally made this bill very short and to the point to ensure that the data that is created is interoperable and can be shared across the emergency response ecosystem, law, fire, EMS, 911, emergency management. I've already referenced facilities. So it was not explicitly stated because we want the local jurisdictions, both in public safety and in education, to make that decision for themselves, and we want this to be open to all vendors. This is not a vendor bill. This isn't for one entity to get. This is for all the great vendors that exist, not only in Minnesota, but nationally that do this, and there are, so they can go through the competitive RFP and win that business. So just wanted to provide those comments. Because this is a mapping bill, I figured having A visual would be helpful, and let's make sure I can get my password. Hey, look at that. So I'm going to just very quickly, just obviously in the interest of time, kind of go through some visuals here so folks can understand what we're talking about. So what we're looking at is a school, and I won't name the school from a privacy standpoint. They've given us the authorization to use this. This is a real school, and they know that we're sharing this publicly, but the school is not named. So what we have here is actually a pretty typical view that a first responder, specifically a 911 telecommunicator, would see when a 911 call shows up. I know these screens aren't large, so I'll try to zoom in. And what we see here is actually a 911 call with several 911 caller locations present on the map. The Deputy Director of Emergency Communication Networks Division, intimately familiar with how 911 works. You may not be. Yes, 911 centers actually may receive multiple locations, and then there's operational decisions on which one to respond to. Needless to say, where is this in the school? And that's what we aim to address. Now, the first responder that's local, they may have an idea of where this is. Maybe they went to the school. Maybe they didn't, though. So, again, the goal here is to ensure all agencies can respond to this emergency as quickly as possible. And, again, this location, and we can talk about 911 caller location technology all day. I know we don't have that. It is very accurate nowadays. Again, 2 to 3 meter accuracy, not even horizontally, but even we're starting to get vertical accuracy as well. So you'll notice that we can actually switch between levels of the school if needed. But generally speaking, what we aim to do is to show public safety where exactly this emergency is located at. And in this case, we can very confidently say that it's in room C206. If you're looking at just the aerial imagery, or you don't even have that, it's best guess. The responder is going there as quickly as possible, maybe not knowing what door to get into. And in this case, we're telling them not only the location, but there's other points of interest that could be added, such as fire extinguishers. There's AEDs. If I go to level one, I know there's an AED in this corridor here. So all those points of interest could be added. So again, we need first responders to an emergency at a school as quickly as possible. We build an indoor map, provision that out to all of public safety so they can get there as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Craigie. Yep. And I know we have at least one member of the public who signed up to testify, Ben Golnick. Come on up and introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mohler and members of the committee. My name is Ben Golnick. I'm speaking on behalf of Critical Response Group, CRG. For purposes of introduction, CRG is composed of relevant practitioners, have mapped over 11,000 schools across the country. We've worked closely with legislative bodies interested in ensuring that public safety professionals have access to accurate school mapping information during an emergency. We are opposed to House File 3805, but applaud the state's effort to introduce school mapping legislation. Based on our extensive experience, there are several issues with the bill. The problem of inaccurate and inaccessible emergency maps is not unique to Minnesota. Public safety agencies and schools across Minnesota rely upon several different software systems when responding to an emergency. This bill has no requirement to share or integrate the mapping data with anyone other than 911 centers. 911 communicators are important to emergency response efforts, but they are not the actual responders involved in an emergency. To ensure public safety agencies have unfettered access to the mapping data, it should be mandatory that school mapping data be integrated into all existing public safety and school systems. Other states have recently introduced their version of school mapping legislation and made this requirement mandatory. The bill establishes no standard for what data must be captured on the maps. State, county, and municipal first responders should be consulted to determine what information should be contained on the maps. This bill has no requirement to verify the accuracy of the map of the location. Like most schools across the country, school buildings in Minnesota are, on average, 50 years old. It is essential that each school be physically walked to verify the accuracy of each map as an initial step. Without this integral part of the mapping process, the state risks putting inaccurate information into the systems that public safety will rely upon during an emergency. We thank Representative Norris for his willingness to lay the bill over today and to engage in meaningful discussions with people most conversant with the problem the bill is intended to address and to consult public safety professionals most impacted by it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else from the audience wish to testify on this bill? Not seeing anybody else, so we can open it up for member discussion, questions. Representative Hewitt.
Representative Norris, thanks for bringing this bill. I was able to meet with the vendor early on along and had a great discussion with him. I look at this as, in my past life of an EMS professional, we literally bring the kitchen sink with us. And to have the truck so far away from where we're actually working, where the patient needs our help, and we always say time is muscle, especially in heart situations, and that's that. It's so important to have our equipment close to us. So I applaud the bill for looking at, you know, making sure we get to the right place at the right time. Now, many times when I talk to the vendor about this, I mean, a lot of people direct us in, and I'm sure the officers on the other side of the room know this too. But it still helps so we know for our pre-planning on where to park, how close we can be to the truck, and things like that. So I think this is a great tool that would really go a long way with it, at least from the EMS community. I've been in schools that I've been totally lost in. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Norris, for bringing this bill forward. I'll have to pick your brain as to how you got that done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've heard from some stakeholders that they feel as if this is exclusionary. What's kind of the deal with that? What language in particular are they saying is concerning, and how do you think that we should go about changing that?
Representative Norris.
Yeah. Thanks, Representative Ingen, for the question, and I know that, you know, school safety is something that you've been really focused on as well, so I appreciate those efforts and would be happy to continue a dialogue around this bill and others with you. You know, I think the previous testifier highlighted a couple of things that we definitely want to look at, you know, the mandatory integration of data, standards about what to include on the maps, you know, verifying accuracy and, you know, kind of weighing the cost benefits of those different approaches. So I'm looking forward to having a good conversation with the various stakeholders and seeing, you know, what tweaks do we need to make to the bill to make sure that all the bases are covered, and then, you know, make sure we're accomplishing the intended goal, which is to help our first responders get to those calls as quickly as possible.
Any follow-up? All right. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Norris, it was fun to build our brain together in our last meeting that we were at. I serve on public safety and on education policy. And so as a teacher for almost 20 years, I'm definitely concerned about I love the idea that our law enforcement know how to understand the building and all these things. I am concerned with such a detailed map. Honestly, I'm concerned about where that could lead and what could happen. As a teacher, I can't even let certain people pick up my students. Like I have you know, places in my software and LMS system that says don't let this person in the building. So, like, I just want to make sure that something like this is not getting into the hands of people that we are concerned about. And also, I was wondering, Madam Chair, if this is something that might be sending off to education policy, since it's something that we should be consulting MDE.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mueller. My understanding is it'll go to education finance. So the intent is to work on some amendments, because those amendments are really relevant to our committee. And then once we have those amendments, we can bring the bill back up and get it sent off to education finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to encourage that maybe policy is where we would put, like, some parameters on how or maybe judiciary, I don't know, on parameters on what would happen to this data. And so I think it's really important to, like, consider what that would look like. I'm happy that it would go to education finance. I just know that they are supposed to only deal with the money at that
point. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. And the devil's always in the details, right? So we'll see what that amendment looks like. And I'm sure that Chair Becker Finn doesn't love another Chapter 13 bill going to her committee, but we'll definitely send it there if it needs to go there once we see what those amendments are. But thank you for highlighting that for us.
Chair Mueller, could Director Craigie perhaps address just briefly some of the questions around privacy?
Yeah, absolutely. Director Craigie.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, excellent question. I can't speak 100% for every vendor or GIS organization in the state of Minnesota, but I can very confidently suggest that when this data is created, data privacy is of the utmost concern, where that if it is stored in the cloud, stored in a cloud-hosted enterprise environment, requires a named user and password to access. It's encrypted both in storage and when it's stored, and then when it's transmitted. The data is only shared with public safety. It's not made available widely. I am acknowledging that some school safety application providers have had some security incidents, and we take those very seriously. And I can say, at least the way that we do it, and the vast majority of companies that we work with on this, it wouldn't be able to happen. Like North Korea and Russia might be able to get to it, like state level actors, but it's just not something that we could do it. And we intentionally did that. We didn't want a file based application because a file could rest on a computer or a device, and that computer or device is then compromised, and they have that file, which again we've seen nationally, but even locally as well.
Thank you, Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Norris, for considering this bill and the work you're doing. And thanks to both the testifiers. On the data, obviously, I hope it's protected due to security data that wouldn't be public. There's probably some amendment we can do so we don't have to rewrite things. I appreciate Representative Hewitt's comments because on these incidents, when minutes and seconds matter, having that right information is important, both for law enforcement, but also our first responders, medics that are responding to the scene. And they are needed, but they also need to be safe, and we don't wanna be putting them in bad areas. I like that you're willing to listen. I'd be glad to help out. I do think that this information needs to be with our personnel on the ground, that it's in real time. Communication becomes a huge issue in these things, and sometimes it's failed, as we've seen in 9/11, but it gets very chaotic. And to have it in real time and support it with law enforcement so we can see where they're moving and all that, I think is important. I think there is a lot that can be done with this bill, and I'm willing to offer whatever I can to help out. But these are very chaotic times, and I think we have to be conscious of that. And I think the intentions are good. I think there's some more work we can do. And like I said, I'm willing to help out however I can. Thank you, Representative Norris.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll try not to repeat too much of what Rep. Whitty just said. I agree on all counts. Well said. I think Rep. Norris, thank you for bringing this forward. I think, you know, we heard that this is an efficient use of funds. It's an efficient use of time. I just wanted to also mention this is an extremely efficient use of communication lines. As, you know, a former dispatcher myself, I know how, again, chaotic and frustrating it can be when you're trying to send help to somebody who desperately needs it and you just can't figure out where the heck they're at. And those moments count. Every second counts. And I think any technology that we can use, we should be using so that we can get to people, get to them in a safer manner, get to them more quickly, and get them the help that they need. And I would assume, too, that any sort of data that relates to this policy would follow the 911 telecoms data practices that we already have. And so, I mean, that could be just a simple pointing to whichever statute that is. But I know we have systems in place already that protect the information that's available to public safety members only and not to the public. I would add, too, that I don't necessarily believe that the bill needs to be completely picked apart as far as, you know, doing a walkthrough of every building and things like that. I mean, we have to consider that ultimately we still have highly trained professionals who are responding to these situations that are often dynamic. They're assessing, reassessing, and, you know, we're not just going to go from having professionals respond to relying on a map to do all the work for us. This is meant to be assistive technology. And so I don't think we have to be too prescriptive about how, you know, how that is utilized, or if we can get information, the best information we have that we didn't have before, let's use that. We should be using it. So thank you.
All right. I don't see anybody else on the list. Do you? Representative Botney.
Thanks. Quick comment and then a question. The comment is that we want to make sure that this gets to the right overseeing facility or agency. I think it probably could have been better given to DPS School Safety Center, just as a suggestion. My question is going to be, what's the $6 million actually go to? And is there anything to stop? Most of the counties have their own GIS sections and could do this work. So what's the $6 million actually going to? And then to tie that in, if the local GIS did the work, would this be open source so they could put that data in and get a lot more bang for the buck?
Mr. or Director Craigie.
Chair Miller, Representative Novotny, great question. As a, again, former state bureaucrat working with these local GIS shops, would highly encourage them to do so. I will acknowledge the capability of doing something like this is very difficult. You need very specific tools, whether you're scanning the building. There's a platform called ESRI, which is the largest GIS platform in the United States, and I would say the world, that they would have to have very specific tooling within that platform to do this. But it wouldn't stop them. So absolutely, the funds could go to their GIS shop if they wanted to build these maps. And they are close partners with their public safety brethren, those GIS professionals. So I would be shocked if they didn't share that information. Again, they work with them on a daily basis. If they couldn't do this, the PSAP could go out to RFP, find a vendor that could do it for the funds that are made available, and then that data would be shared.
Representative Navani.
So this is what I get for stacking too many questions in a row. So what does the $6 million actually buy? Are we covering 20%, 40%, 50% of the schools? What will we get for $6 million?
Director Craigie.
Chair Miller, Representative Novotny. Every public charter, and publicly funded ECFE school and tribal school in Minnesota would be able to be mapped with those funds, 100% of the schools.
Representative Novotny.
Well, that's back to my question. Okay, one single question. What percentage are you looking at doing for $6 million?
Director,
I know they're all eligible.
Chair Moeller, Representative Novotny, this is not mandatory, so the schools can opt in. But for $6 million, and this is looking generally at other, whether it's a GIS shop or vendors, for $6 million, every public school in Minnesota would have access to funds to have an indoor map created. So whether they chose their own GIS shop or a private vendor, that funding would cover all of it.
I'll try it this way. Thank you, Chair. You're from St. Cloud. St. Cloud Apollo High School, if you were to do this without any, you know, from scratch, I assume you're proposing your company would come in and do this. But if your company came in and did it, what would that cost to do St. Cloud Apollo?
Director Craigie.
Chair Miller, Representative Novotny, we've actually done St. Paul Apollo. We've already mapped it. If it was a brand new school, I am not in sales, but I would ballpark it at around $3,000 per school. Now, obviously, size, complexity matters, but that's a rough estimate.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Usually we end with the lead, we do have time. So, Representative Ingen.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So do you guys think that you could do all 2,437 school buildings in the state of Minnesota with that $6 million?
Director Craigie.
Chair Mueller, Representative Egan, absolutely. But I want to be clear here. We're not going to do this all. That it's That's just not how it works typically with these 911 centers and PSAPs who would be getting the funding. They would go out to a competitive process. They would procure it, but absolutely no concern with the funding. And every single school, again, public schools, public charter, tribal, and publicly funded early childhood centers.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair. Last question. You said it was $3,000 approximately for a new school building. What would it be for an existing school building to have that mapping? When you had answered Representative Devani's question, that was the figure that you cited. Mm-hmm.
Director Craigie.
Chair Mueller, Representative Ingen, approximately the same. There are some differences, again, how we do it and how other vendors do it, such as Critical Response Group, I think would matter in these conversations. But generally speaking, that cost would be applicable for both.
All right. Representative Norris, any closing comments?
Thanks, Chair Mueller. I just want to thank the committee for the really productive discussion today. There's a lot of bright minds on these topics in this committee. I think this is a perfect example of how the committee process is supposed to work. We got some good ideas. We're going to go back to the drawing board. We'll probably be back with an author's amendment at some point. But I think overall this is going to be a good step forward for our state. So thanks for the discussion.
Thank you, and thanks to the testifiers. I would encourage all of the stakeholders to work with Representative Norris in a timely fashion, since this bill will have other committee stops, but really appreciate all the testimony and the good questions that we have from the committee today. With that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 3805. The next bill we're gonna hear is House File 3599, the Representative Tabke bill. And we'll also be laying this bill over, so I will move to lay over House File 3599. I don't see any amendments on this bill. And so you're already on the committee, so welcome to the testifiers table. Representative Tabke, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller and members. This is an addition victim rights bill for the end of confinement review. And so when someone was released from confinement, it is not always common practice for, it is not always required for a victim to be notified when that happens. And so what this does is clarifies is a Department of Corrections policy bill that's coming forward today. And what this does, it clarifies that at the end of confinement that a victim, if they so choose, is always notified as to what's going on. And Commissioner Schnell is here to discuss the bill.
Thank you. Welcome back, Commissioner Schnell. Please introduce yourself. You know how this goes, and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Paul Schnell, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I want to thank Representative Tabke for carrying House File 3599 and the committee for considering it today. I also want to be sure to acknowledge and thank Abby Honnold, who is not here today, but it was Abby, whose experience as a victim of sexual violence and the resulting failed responses of our criminal justice system, that it was inspiring and effective voice for change. Abby did this by raising her voice within the community and by continuing to pursue justice despite repeated failures, and by advocating for others who were also failed by our justice system. And by making these injustices known in the Star Tribune's series entitled Denied Justice. She pushed the Post Board to adopt changes and served as a victim advocate, and also served on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission and advocated for federal funding to establish a police training on trauma-informed investigations in response to sexual assault, domestic violence, and dating violence and stalking, known as the Abby Honnold Act. Despite all of this, gaps in our systems persist, and Abby has continued to use her voice and raise that voice on behalf of others. Last October, the man who assaulted Abby requested reconsideration of risk level assignment as permitted by law. This process is known as the End of Confinement Review Committee, or ECRC, which first occurs when a person is released from prison. In this case, upon the release in 2020, the man had a risk level assignment of a level 3. In October of 2023, the ECRC reevaluated that man's risk level assignment. This was done without notification of Abby and no opportunity for her to provide input. The statute in its current state does not allow for notice to victims of an ECRC hearing. It does not allow for notice to victims of what a risk level assignment is for an assigned person, except for level three, which is public. And it does not allow for victims to provide input in ECRC hearings or reassessments. This bill changes that by allowing victims to opt in to receive notifications of end of confinement review or ECRC hearings, as well as the right to provide written input for consideration by a review committee, whether that is the initial review or in any request for reconsideration. I would also point out that Abby has provided written testimony, which I believe has been provided to you. Again, I thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, and I was going to reference that letter from Abby in our packet as well, and it will is posted online also, and just thank you to her for bringing this issue to our attention, and must be exhausting to continue to point out flaws in the system, and glad we at least have the opportunity to address this one today. Do we have other members of the public who wish to testify? I'm not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and I just wanted to point out that it's not just victim survivors like Abby who would be impacted, but I would think it would also be really important that the committee itself would be fully aware so that they can correctly assess the potential dangerousness of the person. So just wanted to point out that it's not just in fairness to the person who is impacted of the known victims, but moving forward, I would think that would be incredibly important to know what kind of individual you're dealing with. So just want to get that on the record. Thank you.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Chair Beckerfin, I would agree wholeheartedly. I think that was one of the observations of Abby, that her input could help inform the committee as to risk factors that may or may not be known by the committee.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. Just out of curiosity and showing some grace to previous policymakers, I'm curious as to how this came to be, this oversight, and if it has ever been noticed prior to Abby bringing it to people's attention.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, no, I think, you know, this has not been that large. I think for many, many times when these cases do come up for ECRC review, which generally is at the end, prior about 90 days to 180 days prior to their release from prison, a risk level assignment occurs, and oftentimes victims may or may not even be aware. They may be more concerned about whether that when that person is being released, but may not pay attention so much to what risk level assignment a person has, and so it doesn't oftentimes impact them necessarily. And so it has not been a significant issue, although there have been some who have been concerned that they wondered why the risk level assignment wasn't higher or why there wasn't a public notification, because those public notifications only occur when the risk level assignment is a level three. And so we have heard that, but the law was silent in terms of victim input on this, and it had never been raised before. Obviously, it was Abby's concern, rightfully, that raised this issue, and it was certainly something that, when it occurred, we concurred that it was an oversight and something that we felt certainly had value, and thus the bill was brought forward.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'll just add, too, that, you know, our criminal justice system is set up in a way that it's state versus the defendant, and there are a lot of areas in the whole system where I think because of that, victims have been excluded from the process for years, and I think there's been a lot of good work, the Victim Rights Act and 611A being one of those examples, but I don't know when this, the timing of this particular legislation, but I think because the focus has always been state versus defendant, that we really do need to go back and look at some of those statutes where we need to make sure that we're including victim survivor input as well. Representative Navani. All right. Oh, well, you shook your head no, and then you grabbed your mic.
Good bill. Well, I thought I hadn't asked to speak, but I think it's a good bill, and I think the victims have to become first. So thank you.
Thank you. Any closing remarks, Representative Tabke?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair Mueller. First, want to say thank you to Commissioner Schnell for bringing this forward and for all the work that they are doing currently on this. And this will help to make sure that we are doing all the right things. But most importantly, to thank Abby for bringing this forward. I just want to highlight part of the letter that everyone has. And she closes her letter with, "I firmly believe that any victim who has chosen to sign themselves up for this type of information deserves to be notified about their offender attempting to receive less supervision, and they deserve an opportunity to speak out about how that will impact them." And so I think that's what this bill does, and I just appreciate everyone's support. So thank you, Chair Mueller.
Thank you. And I renew my motion and lay over House File 3599. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 229. It's a Representative O'Driscoll bill, and we'll also be laying this bill over, so I will move to lay over House File 229. There are no amendments on this bill, and it is good to see you. Welcome to our committee. Please explain your bill, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. First of all, let me tell you, I sound worse than I am. I've been picked up the plague that has been going through staff and members of the legislature with the cough and the hack and things. No snow does not mean there's no cold and flu season, so for whatever that's worth. Really appreciate the opportunity to be able to be here, Chair Mueller. Thank you for hearing House File 229 and members as well. This is a bill that I have been working on for well over 5 years in one way, shape, or form. The purpose of this bill is to provide clarification in the law for registered two sex offender notification. As we're all aware, registered three sex offenders, there is a very public process in which to be able to notify the community and others of interest that there's a registered three level sex offender locating in the community. Level one, like very low likely recidivation, not a lot of, or any notification. Where we get into the difficulty is level two sex offenders. This bill has been brought to me by the Stearns County Assessor's Office a number of years ago. As a matter of fact, it's been pending for quite a while that the assessor himself, who brought this to me, has since retired. We have learned that there's over 1,800, almost 1,900 level two registered sex offenders that are in the communities throughout the state of Minnesota. A level two sex offender disclosure would allow for schools, both public and private, to know of a sex offender, again at level two, daycares in the community, as well as vulnerable persons or victims who may have been victimized by an individual as a level two sex offender. We have quickly come to find out is that people performing service on behalf of the people, such as county assessors going out to do site inspections and property inspections, as well as code officials and other property inspectors, are not allowed under law, or there's some confusion under law as to whether or not they should be given that information as they approach a dwelling to know whether or not a registered two sex offender resides in that dwelling. We feel that that's a point of public compromising public safety for those individuals who do important work on behalf of people in our communities. And we're here today to be able to provide clarification that law enforcement communities and the Department of Correction can, without fear of repercussion, share information with those agencies and those individuals at the time that they are performing their jobs to keep them safe and to be able to make decisions about how they may approach that property. And so with that, Madam Chair, I have no testifiers. We kind of are backed up against the President's Day holiday with getting folks, but the folks I've talked to said that they are glad that we're finally getting our day before your committee. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Sounds good. And I'll first ask, too, if there are any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill. And I am not seeing this. And I'll just say that you and I had a great conversation about this bill as well. And I think one of the challenges we still want to figure out is what different public officials the agency should disclose to, and so trying to get some clarity around that. And I know the Department of Corrections is willing to work on that with us to try to figure that out, because that's pretty broad and not doesn't necessarily need to be every single public official. in a particular location. So I appreciate your willingness to work on that and to work with the department to try to bring some clarity to that. Do we have member questions? Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I just kind of wanted to echo the same need for clarity. Like when you mentioned schools, I like initially when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about like people coming into like just more obvious scenarios where people would come to someone's home. And when we just say that it's for people who are likely to visit the offender's home in the course of their duties and disclosing that to school, it just seems like who are we disclosing it to and why would they be coming to their home? So I just agree that we need some clarity. Thanks.
Yep. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, under Minnesota law, with assessing law, the assessor is required to visit the property every 3 years and when possible make a an indoor inspection of the property. And if you think about it, if there is a level two sex offender that's residing there and you're making a way through the dwelling, there are certainly positions where that assessor could be having their personal safety and be compromised in that property or blocked against their will from being able to get out. And that the same thing would be if you have somebody who's going in as a code official for electric inspections on a home or where many communities will also have inspections that are required in order to be able to have those units be available for lease and occupancy. And so these are the people that I want to try to be able to protect who are providing good service to make sure that people have livable and habitable dwellings and structures as a part of their career to service to the people.
Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you. All of that makes a lot of sense to me. I was just trying to think in the scenario of like school officials and like sometimes schools might make visits to homes if they're worried about truancy and children. And I was just like, how far does it go? Who are we notifying? But what you just described sounds very good to me. Thanks.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And just real quick, I echo some of the concerns of Representative Feist as far as, so what about like a public health nurse visit? You know, it's sort of where does that end? And I'm not saying this is a bad idea. It's just sort of, if we're talking about the actual danger that we're putting folks in, also probably good to remember that there may be dangerous people out there who are not registered sex offenders. And, you know, we should probably be having systems in place to keep people safe regardless. But yeah, I have some concerns as well about how that data is shared and who it's shared with and who needs to have it. So,
yeah, Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Becker-Finn and Representative Vice Chair Feist, I have the same concerns. I have been working for 4 years to try to get to this point with this legislation. And I am happy that you're excited about it like I am and feel that there's a need to do something. What it is, I think it's an open palette to be able to figure out what that picture looks like at the end of the day, but absolutely something needs to be done to be able to protect folks.
Representative Gressel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I guess, you know, I don't know if you know this, but how many level two predatory offenders are in or out there in the state of Minnesota right now?
Representative O'Driscoll.
According to the information I've received, through the Department of Corrections, just under 1,900, about 1,874 individuals. And our level three sex offenders are right around 430 to 450 that are in the community right now in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so that gives us a very good picture of just these people are not the highest risk for recidivism, but they're not, they're pretty darn close. You know, there's the potential is there. And I do share that concern that Representative Becker-Finn talked about as well, is that there are a lot of people out there who have not received the E-level as far as that probably should be on this registry as well. Having had that experience of doing the predatory offender tracking for my sheriff's office, you know, you'd be surprised at who's living where, and the need for that tracking system. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it is also worth noting too that certain people pose a risk to a different type of victim pool than others, and so just making that clear as well. Just because someone has you know, a level whatever classification may not mean, you know, they're a risk to like every single person. But I just think that's part of the discussion that we should be having as well. Representative Pinto.
Yeah, just building on that, Madam Chair, and just a reminder that, as was noted by Representatives Becker, Finn, and Grossel, that there may be folks who pose a risk who are not currently identified by the system. That's a big concern. I think there also is a concern that you got folks who may be identified by the system. We want to look at and say, are we in fact, are these folks who are posing an ongoing risk based on the system that we have? So, you know, somebody who's convicted of, is charged with a certain crime that may actually have nothing to do with predatory offending behavior. They're convicted of something completely different, but because the crime was classified a certain way, and then maybe a number of years pass, they're convicted of some completely unrelated crime, but they end up staying within our predator offender system. We're spending a heck of a lot of money tracking a number of people. So in any case, just recognize the kind of things can both go both ways. We're doing the best that we can. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto, for raising that point. This committee will probably remember when we did the criminal sexual assault overhaul. A big part of the recommendation of that working group was to look at our predatory offender registration statutes and some of the unfairness, actually, that you referenced that are built into those statutes. I've introduced a bill, worked very closely with Representative Rarick on this issue, and I do anticipate that that will be coming to the committee this year, and we'll be having those discussions. So this is not the only time we'll be addressing these issues. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Driscoll, thank you for the bill. I have a couple of questions. One, was the law enforcement already have the authority to provide this data?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you for the question, Representative Frazier. My understanding in visiting with the people who brought this to me, they did not have clarity when they were visiting with law enforcement, and law enforcement didn't know if they had the ability to be able to share that information. What we're hoping to do is to provide a clear line so that they know what they shall and shall not be able to disseminate.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you for that. That makes sense. I thought that was the case. And the other question is, so say, I'm just trying to practically play this out. I'm an assessor. There's a house I'm going to visit. I get the notification. Then what?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Frazier. Great question. So if I, as the assessor's office, and I know that we have a level 2 sex offender resident that's residing in a home, we have to go there. So maybe instead of sending one assessor, I send two assessors to be able to have the buddy system. Or I maybe look at the time of day that we schedule that to be able to be at a safer time, or to perhaps enlist the help of law enforcement, let them know that we're going to be going into that area, and then maybe a patrol drive-by just to make sure that everything is fine, to, again, increase the safety of the person who's attending to their professional duties at that residence.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you.
Okay. You're just giving you one more. You're shaking your head no, and you mean it this time. Okay. Great. And I will say that last line of questioning, I think it was really important, Representative Frazier and Representative O'Driscoll, if you can check in with law enforcement as well, since they'll be doing the notifications, I think it would be great to have their input too as we work on perhaps an amendment to your bill. So any closing comments?
Thank you again for the opportunity to be able to be here. I know there are many protected groups that we need to be looking at. Let's do one group at a time right now. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's take care of folks, and then as we learn more, we can bring more into the fold to continue to protect all of our public servants. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 229. And we next have up House File 472, a Representative Hewitt bill. And we do have an A1 amendment. So first I will move to lay over House File 472, and then Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, that is my motion.
And it looks like the amendment just updates the effective date. Any discussion of that? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Madam Chair and committee, thanks for hearing this bill. I'm actually sickened that I have to bring this before you. As most of you know, I am a sports official for the Minnesota State High School League. To have to even discuss this and wishing for other ways to try to elevate the problem that's out there. We're losing refs every year. It's terrible. I mean, I'm 58, and they're begging me to stay another year. which I'm pretty good in physical fitness, but, you know, those days are ending soon. But we're not getting younger refs either. And this is important because this isn't just in the sport athletic world, but it's also in the judges of dance and of the judges of debate. All these are victims of bad players. And what do I mean by that? Last year up in the Detroit Lakes area, I'm not bringing up the school personally, but what happened was we had a basketball incident where a fan jumped over the team, threw popcorn at the referee. I believe he ripped his whistle off and pushed him. He was charged with fifth-degree assault. So nothing really happened. I mean, fifth-degree assault, I know for many of you are going to say, well, that's pretty good, but I'm kind of sickened by this because this person put himself in a situation where, you know, that's not what he was there. My job as a referee is to make sure the players are safe, make sure the rules are followed, and to make sure the players and the coaches have the best experience they can. That's my job. And if you have somebody yelling at you, this year has been remarkably bad because this year I've gotten, I mean, my calls are great, but this year has, this year has gotten a little bit strange. Even I had a incident here in St. Paul recently where I was actually afraid to walk out to my car, and I've never had that in 19 years. And so I'm asking the committee, if not this, what? I'm going to take a break from my words here and turn it over to my good friend here from the Minnesota High School League, Mr. Martins, and he's going to talk about what their vision, what their lens is on this.
Welcome to the committee. Eric Martins, please introduce yourself for the record and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Martins and I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota State High School League. For context, I also was a high school principal in two different high schools and a teacher and a coach before that. On behalf of the league and its more than 600 member schools, we appreciate the consideration that's given to finding ways to reduce the highly respectful, disrespectful, and unsafe behavior that a very small percentage of our spectators engage in at our youth events. We appreciate Representative Hewitt's efforts to bring greater safety and respect to our officials, specifically targeting those spectators who engage in these kinds of assaultive behaviors. We also thank Representative Hewitt and all officials across the state for making our activities possible and serving our students and our member schools. Safe and respectful contests and programs has been the focus of the Minnesota State High School League, especially in the last couple of years. We've worked really hard with our students. We've been at 9 different regional sites this past fall, bringing student leaders together to talk about how we can make our events and our programs as safe as possible, culminating in a statewide conference in December with 650 students and more than 70 schools involved. What we know is that when these behaviors take place, they put all of those students and programs, as well as other spectators, and certainly the officials, at risk, and we're highly concerned about that. We need our spectators to be great examples for our students, make sure that our events are 100% safe for all who take part in them. In considering the expanse of the Minnesota State High School League, and we're obviously not the only youth sports provider in the state, but oftentimes very visible, if we take just 5 activities, football, volleyball, soccer, hockey, and basketball, certainly some that you would know of or have seen, this year we probably have about 40,000 contests that take place at either the varsity or the junior varsity level. That's an awful lot, right? It takes a lot of our officials to be able to cover all of those, and we certainly want those to be as safe as possible and to have everyone participate in the way that we would expect. We continue to work out ways that we can increase our support for our schools. I know our schools are doing an incredible amount of work managing contests and keeping track of spectators. Our students are actually leading in a lot of these situations, grabbing the microphone before contests and talking to the crowd about expectations, having student leaders in the student sections as to what their behavior should be, what it should look like. But again, any of these, what I'm going to call outlandish and highly dangerous situations, threaten the safety of our contests. Minnesota State High School League does not have all the answers. We certainly respect and appreciate Representative Hewitt bringing this to the forefront. and will continue to work together as we try and formulate ways in which we can increase the safety of all of our events. Thank you so much for your time and your concern for all of our programs and our students, and I would be glad to answer any questions if I could.
Thank you, Director Martins. Do we have any members of the public who wish? I do see a hand over there, so come on up. Oh. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hughes. You can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Moeller, this is an honor for a little guy like me, but thank you for having me, members of the committee, Representative Hewitt. In my past life, I had some dealings with the Minnesota State High School League and as far as hockey, but we're not here to talk about that today. There are two bills today, and I should have done the first one that I'm going to tie off. We are raised at home on how to behave in public, and if you act up, you're going home, that kind of things. But it bothers me that we got people throwing popcorn at the referees and all that, because we're talking respect when we play a sport and how to win and lose, I think. And it bothers me that we have to change the language to protect ourselves because people act out because we're afraid of public behavior, we're afraid to go out to our cars. That doesn't need to be. There is no penalty tough enough. And I think this really, it doesn't have to be decided today, but it has to keep getting reviewed and looked at. It's a very serious issue. And the other thing is that I want to tie off the geographical system, which was the first bill here.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. We can't talk about that bill because we've already.
But I'm just going to make a point.
Okay.
I hope the day comes that we don't have to review this language and go to the schools to rescue a referee and use that system. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Anybody else wish to testify? All right. We can move on to member discussion. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. I don't think your calls have gotten bad. I think it's probably
totally agree.
You offered it. I just unfortunately we've seen this too often, and it's in our professional sports where people are how they're acting and getting charged. As a former SRO, I've seen it when I'm contracted there. I've walked many officials out after a game. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. I was president of Minnesota Thunder Soccer Academy, and I'm still on the board, and we're having a tough time at the youth level finding referees. And we try to show that respect, and a lot of times these are kids. And unfortunately, it's parents and the emotion of the game. So I appreciate you bringing this forth because there has to be consequences for people's actions in the heat of the moment. So thank you.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for lifting up this issue. I'm not fully there on whether, like, increasing penalties actually would change behaviors, because it's been my experience that usually it's kind of heat-of-the-moment things, and those of you who sat on the sidelines at a high school game also know that you already know who the parents are that tend to get out of control. It's not like it's just one game where all of a sudden they're displaying the behaviors that are disrespectful. But I also just wanted to note, you know, while we have the State High School League here, that I've also heard anecdotally from folks, especially some of our reservation schools, public schools located on the reservations, that, you know, the incidence of racist things that are said by coaches, players, fans has been increasing. We had an incident in my hometown last week, multiple technical fouls, and very easily could have turned into a really bad situation. But luckily, it was the students who in the school who were really the leaders in tamping things down and not reacting to the behaviors that they were seeing. But I do think it's important to sort of lift up that it's primarily the adults that are doing these behaviors that are entirely inappropriate over a game. So I'm glad you bring it forward. I think it's important. And again, I I just want to note too that it's I think it's gotten, it does, it has gotten worse, not just the games that you're reffing.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, and Chair Becker-Finn, you spoke really well. There's a parallel bill moving right now, and I was hoping it would get to your committee, but we had to stall it this morning. And it's basically takes care of, well, will it? We don't know. It's again like this one that deals with the fan problem. And we do have schools that have, you know, we have racial things going on. We have what we call the, now I'm drawing a blank, but it's the fan bill. And that's the one you've been hearing about, the irate fan bill. Unruly fan, thank you. And that bill there, we're going to focus more on the fan behavior and help kind of curve that in. And they say if you bring home a $1,000 fine, you may curb your behavior a little bit. And that's kind of where that goes, but we had to stall it out because it's a civil penalty, and I hope to sooner or later get it to your committee. But we think just printing that on a brochure might help, but we can't until we have the bill. So, but interesting enough, one of the facts that came out of that this morning and why we had to stall it, because the Amateur Sports Commission is the one that would actually levy the fine. They needed to go on pause because they did a little study earlier, and they said, how many situations do you think this will be, Representative Hewitt? And I go, oh, you know, maybe 50 throughout the whole state. They could refer 1,000 cases now. 1,000 cases now. And that's ridiculous. That tells you how severe this is and how, and like Representative Whitty said, we start really young right now. We're trying to get the youth into this. A college kid could go out for a weekend, ref a tournament, and make really good money. And we like it because then hopefully they will become adult refs. And the same thing with soccer. And what we do is we start them in high school, and no one wants their kid to be subjected to that kind of behavior. And it's really good and it's honorable to have them out there, but we don't want to hurt them. And so that's where a lot of the 1,000 referrals would come from, is that soccer. I didn't know soccer people were this terrible. sorry, Representative. But it just stunned me this morning. And I'm going to bring it back to this, where we're looking at the criminal offense. And but I really do appreciate that, Representative Chair Becker-Finn. I'm hoping to get that bill to you.
Let's see. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hewitt, thanks for your work on this and for the conversations we've had. And I know this is a huge, a big and growing problem. And it does seem like you sort of talked about what things could be done. And I know that the current civil penalty, it sounds like, is pretty limited. It's a one-year ban. And so there may be things that can be done. I will admit that, and as you and I have talked about, I have hesitations about this particular way of addressing it. So just a reminder that assaulting a sports official is currently a crime, right? It is a crime. So if there's any criminal referral needs to be made, it can be made. It's the same level of crime as assaulting a teacher, assaulting a doctor who doesn't work in an emergency room, assaulting all kinds of folks. And I guess to the extent the thought that would be this might be a deterrent, I guess I agree that I don't know that somebody who is going to go after a ref, right, is going to consult the statutes and figure out, wait a second, this would have been a misdemeanor, but now it's going to be a gross misdemeanor. I guess I won't assault them when I would have if it would have been a misdemeanor, right? Like, we want to think about our criminal statutes as a setting up a structure that, to my mind, is driven a lot by kind of how bad do we think the behavior is. I mean, I don't know how much it's going to deter. There's various things. But we just say, listen, your behavior is so bad, we're going to call it a crime. And then it's so bad, we're going to call it a gross misdemeanor felony. This is bad behavior. What worries me is that adding it to this assault in the fourth degree, making it be a gross misdemeanor, I just feel like I've seen through the years, and you can see the trend of adding more and more and more professions. What started off as being about law enforcement, which was in Subdivision 1, has sort of kept getting added. And I can't think of a principled place to stop and you keep on, we can keep on adding more and more and more until sort of anybody with authority assaulting them is assault in the fourth degree. And then we kind of say, well, wait a second, then the people without authority, boy, they probably need protection too because they don't have authority. And then suddenly we're just sort of cranking up penalties. So I do have concerns about the direction, about using the criminal law in this way. I'm sympathetic to the idea that somebody in this position sort of is like a judge or somebody else covered by assault four. And I can think of other folks in that spot too. So I'm trying to think creatively, as I know that you are, about ways that we can address this actual concern without necessarily altering the assault in the fourth degree statute in exactly this way. So looking forward to ongoing conversations about that.
Representative Hewitt.
Chair Pinto, thank you so much. And thank you for talking to me about this earlier. You're right. I mean, I would like to look at other ways too. I'm one of those ER workers that this covers. I was one, not anymore. And looking through this, Chair Becker Finn just said something that really resonated with me. We know these parents. We know the ones that are going to do it. This probably is an escalated incident over time. And I do think that when you jump out on a floor, in this one case, jump over a team, throw popcorn, and grab the ref in front of all those children and in front of all the stadium, you have now broke some pretty important barriers. And that's where I'm having trouble with that. I'm with you because I don't like raising penalties either, but that person needs to see a judge because there's a behavior modification that has to take place. How it is, I don't know. But I appreciate having the prosecutors here to kind of help me sort through this as this is being held over. So I'm open for suggestions, but that's exactly where it breaks the barrier. And when all those kids are there, because I go back to it and I was hoping Representative Mueller would.
Don't worry, I'm on the list.
She's all right. On the list. She's up next.
You guys should be quiet then.
Yeah.
Well, we can. That this is really about the kids. This is about the experience that we provide for the kids. I'll shut up now, hopefully.
Representative Mueller.
Ask and you shall receive. No. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Mr. Martin, for your testimony on this. As a teacher for almost 20 years, I have seen some of the things that Minnesota State High School League has done to try to coach our students and train our students and being leaders in front of those parents that are just not doing what they need to be doing. The super fan, I think it was, Academy, I know several of my students who've gone through that, and it's been incredibly rewarding and effective in my school. I actually had a question about a specific line in your bill, so hopefully it's okay for me to do this. Line 119, it says that we have to look at a sports official, blah, 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 and that means that they're traveling between the premises and public transit stop or motor vehicle. So this is just me trying to get some clarification. I completely, when you gave your anecdote of, I didn't even want to go out to my car. Like, at that point, after the game, at that point, people know who you are, people have seen you, they've seen you ref the game and all of those things. When a person is coming to the game, and while it's probably not a very, you know, high incident of people being like, oh my gosh, it's a ref, you know, that's probably not what's happening. I wanted to know if this line could be both ways to and from the game, and then if it does, I just want to know, because I'm not a ref and I don't know, when you arrive at the game, are you required by the Minnesota State High School League to be wearing your uniform at that point? Like, can people identify that you are coming to a game to ref that game? If not, then if you're just hanging out at a bus station waiting to get to the game and someone assaults you, does this apply here? Like, we already talked about how Chair Pinto was like, well, there's already laws against assaulting someone. So I just wanted practicality. What does this look like? Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair and Representative Mueller, thank you. That's a great question. No, we're not required, but we can. I mean, they're not going to tell us what we wear or what we don't wear. It's very obvious who we are. When we walk in, we usually have a suitcase or backpack with us. They know what we're coming for. The incidents that I've heard about, I'll share one real briefly with you, is I reffed with a female ref last year who is no longer with us this year. That was basically, I would say it was assault, but she refused to report it because it made her look weak. Basically, she was leaving, exiting the school, and a parent walked up to her, a male grabbed her by the arm, and basically said some stuff that he shouldn't have said. Thank God her partner saw her and went over there. But that's what I'm trying to protect, is that, and I can't remember anybody in 20 years telling me that I, you know, on the way in there, I'll want to kind of like you. but yeah, I guess going in and stuff, but I'm open to clarifying, as I am open to Representative Pinto's statements here. What can I do? I'm open to anything right now.
And I'll just say, I think that she raises a good point too, because that someone's not even in a uniform, a person wouldn't even know that they're a referee. It could just be a random assault, which isn't good. We don't want that. But then they would somehow qualify under this statute. So I think you raise a good point, perhaps about the broadness of that particular line. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I actually really support this bill. I've seen it personally. I played hockey, football, and baseball growing up in White Bear Lake, and I think some days hockey's the official city religion of White Bear, so people get pretty fired up. But it's happening more and more. I actually play town ball nowadays on Wednesday nights with one of my coaches who referees alongside you, I believe. And so it's a small world, but this is definitely happening more. I've seen it, and it's just a beer league game where we're trying to pretend like we're still as good as we were in college. So I support it. I think it's a good idea, and to Chair Pinto's point that this could be extended to other things, maybe it should be. Maybe there are cases in which we need to try to deter it with some sort of proactive measure, and this might be one of those avenues. So I appreciate the bill and look forward to talking more.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for presenting this bill today. And I just wanted to acknowledge that we've seen an alarming number of adults across the state and country with really big feelings about children's sports. And this is creating anxiety for everyone that just simply has no place and isn't necessary. So I see this bill as protecting spaces for kids to enjoy the activities that they love with their peers. That's what we should be doing, and I thank you for highlighting this issue and bringing this forward.
And Representative Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hewitt, I am sorry that you got to bring that forward as well. You know, it should sicken all of us that these kinds of things go on, but it begs to, you know, for us to really look at. Representative Pinto made a good point, is that we have laws on the books. We have these things that will address these issues, these assaults and so on. You know, this shows a good example of too many things have been left unchecked. Too many things have been allowed to continue without accountability. And I've listened to teachers, I've listened to other groups, I've listened to law enforcement attorneys. I mean, you hear all of these different things. Everybody's coming with, you know, there's some issues out there that need to be addressed, and these are societal issues that need to be addressed, to where their needs, we got to get back to accountability. It starts at home. People think we throw money at it, we throw more stringent laws at it, that's going to cure it. No, it's not. It's going to keep getting worse all the time. Until we as the adults start to say, no, enough of this BS. Use the stuff we have on the books. There's no need to continue to make more laws when we should be able to say, you know, this, you don't do this in school at a school event. You know, it was unspeakable in my day. I mean, somebody might have said, you need glasses, you know. As they make a bad call or whatever.
Last night, yeah.
But you heard that last night, you know. So I mean, it is sad that we have to come to this. It is really sad, and I think we all need to take a look inside as to How can we do this better? How can we do this without increasing penalties? And just use the stuff that we have and teach people respect and for others. So that's all I have to say on it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I think that sort of begs the question. I mean, I had that as well, and you sort of referenced a particular referee who didn't report it. Some of the crimes that would qualify already, assault that Chair Pinto mentioned, I can think disorderly conduct perhaps. And I guess I'm really curious, like, are they even being reported? You did mention someone at the beginning of your explanation of the bill who reported it, somebody else who didn't. Are referees reporting this? Are they afraid to report it? How do we encourage that to happen? And I don't know if that's a question for you or Director Martins, but.
Well, I'm going to actually share that question here, if it doesn't matter, because I'm sure the director. I look at it totally from a referee side. Referees are always trying to advance, right? So we're always, we go from the youth level all the way up to the collegiate level. And a lot of referees look at reporting schools or reporting incidents at school as something they did, because we're in control of the game. If this is problematic, that we had a problem at a game, we really take that personal. And they feel that, okay, maybe I'll wait till tomorrow to report it, or maybe I'll wait till later to, you know, and then it never gets reported. And I'm guilty of this. I had an incident, like I said, this year, and it's a lot easier not to report it. Now, I'm sitting next to the league, so I might not be reffing next year for sure because of this. They want us to report it. I got to say, the league has really stepped up, but they're limited to what they can do. So I'm going to let him kind of talk about that aspect of it.
Yes, thank you. And I'm sorry to, like, throw a question. We only have a few minutes, and we do have at least one other member on the list. So Director Martins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. As we talk about incidents that take place, we do rely on our officials to report to the league, and also those reports go directly back to the school that's hosting the competition, right? And so there's a reporting in what I'm going to call a general sense, and then there would be, you know, reporting in terms of, you know, a legal sense when it comes to that. So we are the clearinghouse for those reports, and we send them back, and our schools are responsible to address those behaviors that take place within their schools. And take action relative to those, given the bylaws that exist around the rules at the State High School League when we go forward. In terms of bringing forward any charges, that again becomes a personal piece, not something that is going to be a league, because we are not in a position where we are going to be the ones making the determination on any kind of a legal claim that would come forward. But when it comes to any of those reports, we do encourage, and I appreciate Representative Hewitt saying that, in fact, even calling officials and say, so we heard something happened. We need your account of what took place so that we can, one, make sure that we're addressing, first of all, the victims, if there are individuals who have been victimized by whatever took place, as well as then making sure that schools are following through with whatever consequences are there, and also to continue to do their best to control the events that we have. And there's been so many different ways that our schools have been creative in trying to make sure and control the spectators at their contests, and appreciate all the work that they're doing.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill and addressing this issue. And it's nice to have a little bit extra time to have a more in-depth conversation. Our committee workload doesn't always allow for that. And it's given us the opportunity to kind of unpack some of these ideas that impacts the policy that we make, and it's encouraging to hear Chair Pinto kind of wrestle with what are those limiting principles that keep us from the scope of what we're doing creeping and creeping forward. And I'd like to try to suggest a couple of possibilities for what those limiting principles might be, and Representative Curran actually did a pretty good job from your guys' perspective in terms of articulating one of them, and that's the idea of recognizing the broader impact of a crime based upon what the victim is entrusted to do. So at a certain level, yes, we're talking about referees in sports games, but at a certain level, they've been empowered with a form of public trust. We're saying you're the one who's here to keep the peace, keep the order of the game. And so an attack upon them is more than just an attack upon an individual person. It's an attack upon that kind of institutional order, right? And so I think one of the limiting principles we could potentially look at is that a factor in any given future proposal to add to this list? You know, is the attack going beyond the individual person
to a broader institution that they've been empowered to represent. And the other factor that I think comes into play when we're considering these sorts of expansions is just likelihood. One word that you guys like to bandy around quite a bit is disparities. Well, this is an observed disparity in how frequently people are being assaulted by virtue of what it is that they're employed to do. And so by recognizing that it's a problem that is having a disproportionate impact, this is a disproportionate penalty, trying to match that out and level it out so that we address the issue and affect peace. So thank you.
Representative Hewitt, and we have like just a couple minutes left. So did you have a response?
I can't respond to it because I think you did a real nice job of explaining it. And I would thank you, Representative Hudson. I can close real quick. Yes, there is a bill. There is a law on the books that says, and Speaker Svigum actually was a referee. He's retired now. Put that law there. He got total support on that. And it was exactly that. You cannot come to a sporting event for a year. We don't have a registry for sporting bad people. We maybe could do that, put a registry together. But it's just not out there, and it's not enforced. You maybe can't go to your hometown because they know who you are, but you can definitely go to three towns away. And so this bill needs to be something. I don't know what. I really appreciate the dialogue. Chair, thank you for hearing it. It seems like this was sports official day, so it was kind of cool. So thank you, and I think this sends a message to all our officials throughout the state that we do care, we want to do something, we just don't know what it is yet.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And I renew my motion and lay over House File 472 as amended. That is it for our agenda. And I just want to say thanks, members, for the robust discussion on all the bills today. I think it was a really good and respectful and helpful discussion. So that's how we do the work. And just wanted to say I appreciate that. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.